Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9, and coming at you from the center of the universe, and that is Clear Creek County, Colorado. And this is Writer's Talk on the Rabbit Hole, and today, special guest, one of my old friends here, Tim Hall. Tim, welcome.
Well, thank you, Jerry. I'm so glad to be here. So appreciate it. Love Clear Creek and love Idaho Springs and Georgetown and just God's country.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, because you come up not only for, you've been on the show with me before.
One time, a couple years ago, with related to my other book called Marines Never Cry.
Yeah, we'll do a quick synopsis of that if you like. You know, just as a refresher for people. And that was a great conversation. And you come up for the Book Nook at the Christmas Market.
I do.
In Georgetown. And looking forward to having you back again this year.
Love it. We'll be there. I'll be for sure.
All right. So, so Tim, tell us a little bit more about you. You know, we talked about briefly, you just mentioned your book, Marines Never Cry. So, you were a Marine, always a Marine, right? Semper Fi.
That's what they say.
All right. So tell us more about you and what got you into writing and maybe some of your other experiences too. Your because a lot of it's in your new book here. We're going to be talking about flying upside down. Mm-hmm. So,
Well, thank you, Jerry. Again, appreciate being here. Our family is family of writers and kind of reinforced writing. I have a little book of short stories that I wrote in 1958. Just a lovely little time. I'm so glad I kept it. And so there's been that orientation, and it's been enjoyable. Now, I've been retired. I was the executive director of Laridon Hall, which is a program for children and adults with developmental disabilities, Colorado's first school, actually, for children and adults with disabilities. And before I retired, I was executive director of the Colorado Department of Human Services, deputy executive director of the Colorado Department of Human Services. My department was Veterans and Disabilities Services. So anyway, did a lot of work along those lines. And now that I'm retired, I've just gotten around people who write, like yourself, and just started doing it. Didn't think I could, but got around people who were very encouraging and started to write down some things. I started with a story that I thought was important related to my time in the Marine Corps and in Vietnam, and taking a little bit different approach to it. And that did pretty well in terms of the ratings and reviews and awards, and I appreciated that a lot. So I thought I would then go to something a little bit less heavy, a little bit lighter, and sort of talk about my time flying, which was about 8 years. I just thought it would be worthwhile to communicate not just the process of learning how to fly an airplane, which many people have done, but go a little deeper in that and talk about why and what you get out of it, and some of the crazy fun things that I did that I think people would appreciate. Mm-hmm. And the first one was a little hard, like I say, and a little... Marines Never Cry. I call that R-rated, and that's what happens when you write about war and things like that. This one here, I say to family and friends, it's G-rated, but it will put a tickle in the seat of your pants if you read it.
Yeah, well, the first one, you said it to me, it was memoirish in a way.
Absolutely.
You drew on personal experiences, but you put it in context of fiction. Mm-hmm. So you created a character. This one, it's more memoir, and it gets into something also that's pretty personal here, too, which we'll really talk about, and that is conquering fear.
Absolutely. Yes, Jerry, the subtitle is Life Lessons for the Faint of Heart, and I didn't mean that in any way. We're all faint of heart in some way or have been, but sometimes you've got to get over it. Sometimes it's so life-limiting, fears, concerns, self-doubt, that you have to face these things dead on or you cannot live your life. I mean, really, think about it. Flying, I mean, it's necessary in modern life. If you're so afraid of flying, you can hardly even look at an aircraft. Well, you know, that's going to be life limiting. So you're going to take the train everywhere? Some people can do that maybe, but No, I just decided it was just very, very important. I was in a job for a major consulting firm that still exists, flying was everywhere, crossed over to Micronesia, Samoa, around the country, and I had to do a lot of flying. And I thought the only way that I'm going to get used to this or deal with it is to learn how to fly. And how did I learn? How did I come to that conclusion? Because one of the flights was from San Diego over to El Centro, California, which is just a hop, skip, and a jump. But in those days, you could actually ride with the pilot. There was an extra seat. He said, "You want to ride with me?" I said, "Okay, sure, I'd just love it." But watching him in action, watching how he controlled that aircraft, so smooth, so precise, I thought, my goodness, maybe that is the answer. I think I could do this. I might try this. And I did.
Well, let's back up a little bit, because what launched this now? Because we call that acrophobia.
Oh, my, yes.
Yeah, and it's fear of flying, which is different. Is that different than fear of heights?
Aerophobia and acrophobia, both heights and okay. and flying.
What precipitated it in your life?
Well, I believe that it was attributable to this really terrible accident that I was in as a kid. I want to laugh, but it's the way it was. We went off a bridge. My grandfather was driving the car. I was in the back with my grandmother, and Gramp fell asleep, lo and behold, went off the side of the bridge, upside down, and came down, 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 almost into the water, into the river. But we landed upside down on the riverbank, tore the back wheels off, and I can remember every single detail. Grandparents were hurt badly. And anyway, so I assume it was actually, it really was that, because from then on, I mean, I couldn't even as go down an elevator, go to a store. My mother gets me, get on, come on the elevator. No. It was a very, very serious phobia. And it followed me all the way through. But I just decided again that I just really needed to do that.
You know, conquer or at least meet the fear, because it sounds like as if it's a traumatic experience in people's lives. Mm-hmm. And for you, it was this major accident. Mm-hmm. It could be a number of other things for many other people, but something that, particularly at a younger age, that happens. Absolutely. I think of an automobile accident that I was in back when I was in my later 20s, mm-hmm. or 30s, I'm sorry, and how that stuck with me, and then my ability to get back in the car.
Absolutely.
And even to this day, mm-hmm. I cannot tailgate. I refuse to. It's not a safety thing, but someone pulls, I give them space because of that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And sometimes, as difficult as it is, the only way to deal with these things, and this is one of the life lessons, there's a lot of life lessons. They may be things that we all know, but they're worth repeating in this book. They just come out. I mean, you're gonna have to do these things. It's just anything. But this, my attitude about that was, I'm going to face this. I'm going to spit in the face of fear. And I don't mean to sound overly dramatic about it, but that's what it was. It's the only way. It's either that or cringe. Don't go. Don't fly. Don't take that job. Why don't you just go build a little, live in a trailer somewhere and never go anywhere. And I just decided to deal with it. And by golly, once I started that, mm-hmm. and it was scary. I had an instructor that was as aggressive, as assertive, as precise and demanding as any drill instructor I ever had in the Marine Corps. He didn't mess around. And he gave me a long lecture before I started this. I told him why I wanted to fly and what my fears were. And he said, well, this is what we're going to do. And he gave me the whole rundown. And we're going to do this. And I'm going to teach you some things that are not necessarily required by the Federal Aviation Administration. But you're going to learn how to fly safely for yourself and your passengers. And it's going to involve things like spin recovery. Spin recovery? Oh, my good Lord. What next? On and on and on. And he was very, very precise. So one thing led to another. We moved on past the the basics of flying to actually aerobatic flying. And part of aerobatic flying was parachuting, which I did not realize at the time. Yeah. Well, he said, you know, we're going to go up and we're going to practice these things. I'm going to show you how to recover, and I'm going to show you how to do this and that. What happens if you don't recover from a stall, for instance? If you do not recover, just hold it in a stall, see what happens. So we're going to do some of that. So I see we have to tie on a parachute as we're in the plane, right? We're in tandem, so he's behind me. And I said, what's the parachute? He said, well, if we need to, you pull the cotter pin out, your door falls off, you jump out, you pull these. I said, come on. All right. He said, okay, what we'll do is go to parachute school in Antioch, California, because I got my license. This is in Hayward, California, in the Bay Area. And so we went to parachute school. So from then, you know, it just one thing led to another. And I ended up doing quite a bit of aerobatic flying. Even, you know, things evolved. You think you can, one thing builds upon another. And when I came to Colorado, I did some aerobatic flying and then happened to see the old movie, The Great Waldo Pepper. Yeah. Robert Redford. And I had done the inside loop. I had done all kinds of things, but I had never done the outside loop. And they had seemed to have a problem doing it in the movie. You know, the planes weren't strong enough and so on and so forth. So I did it. Went up to Boulder, got a hold of somebody who was very good at doing that, and we did it. Lord, Lord, I can tell you. But again, one thing builds upon another. You build confidence. And this isn't daredevil stuff. It was all designed to become a better pilot so that in the case of if there was a situation that you encounter, particularly in the mountains of Colorado or anywhere else, you'd be able to handle it. So you're sort of driven by fear that you really would not be able to handle a difficult situation. So you try to encounter, just do these things. Learn how to anticipate so that if you ever have this problem, just like Marine training, if you ever have this, you'll know what to do.
Yeah, and I want to go back to that a little bit, not to focus because we have had other conversation about Marines never cry and people can listen to that. But it seems to me that what led to you going into the Marine Corps and what got you to flying, I don't want to say it's coincidence, but happenstance, something that, you know, it was there in front of you and it was like a life experience. So in this case here for flying, you had that intrinsic fear, perhaps, mm-hmm. probably, mm-hmm. from your boyhood, mm-hmm. understandably so. Mm-hmm. And okay, it's back there. Never give it much thought. It's just there. Okay. And then you just happen to be on this plane with this pilot there who, and all of a sudden, a light goes on, a switch gets flicked. Similar to going into the Marines when you were a boy. I think you grew up near New York, New Jersey.
Northeastern Pennsylvania.
Okay, yeah. Northeast Pennsylvania, Scranton area, area. Mm-hmm. Okay. And it gets there. So, you know, the synchronicity, maybe that's the word I'm looking for, the synchronicity of life presents these four, and it's there. Mm-hmm. And now you have the opportunity to deal with stuff. That's my thinking.
Well, yeah, it in the Marine Corps, you go into the service for a lot of reasons, but, you know, we are baby boomers, you know, our fathers were in World War II, so, you know, you have some of that orientation. But in my particular situation, going into the Marine Corps was, well, it's certainly, and for most people, it's life-changing, but it what it does, and probably any experience like this, I won't say it's just the Marine Corps, I don't want to, that's the only thing. People go through and they do things that are extraordinarily challenging and it builds confidence. And there are some things that build confidence in such a way that you dare try other things and expose mm-hmm. yourself to these things. You'll try them. Why? Because you know that you can, under some circumstances, succeed. You have enough confidence to try things. And I said in the beginning of the book, but never to try is not an option. You must try these things. You must try something. And little by little, you gain the confidence. And what I think is interesting is that once you gain that confidence, even if you try something new now, this is another challenging thing you're going to do, like flying. I risked myself, I guess, in trying to fly because I knew that even if I didn't succeed, I would give myself an A for at least trying.
Right.
Okay, you know, and it wouldn't shatter me for life if I didn't, pass, fail. If I failed, so what? I've already accomplished a few things in life that, but what the beauty of it is, if you dare to try something new and build upon some success that you've had, and lo and behold, you are successful again, reasonably. I mean, nobody's perfect. You know, you could rate yourself a B. It's not an A, you know. But you did it, and you're good at it. Well, lo and behold, now that gives you another stepping stone, a building block, to try other things, like skiing. I mean, I know this sounds really, but I talked about that a little bit. In skiing, I came to Colorado. I'm a pilot, right? I don't want to ski. Oh, my God. You know, going downhill and moguls and then somebody, encouraged me. And I fell a lot. And I even have a section in there saying if you're not falling, you're not learning something.
Right.
You're not learning anything.
When you bring up the idea of risk, you say you take risk there. Talk about him in context, particularly with this story now, flying upside down, in terms of both being vulnerable, willing to be vulnerable, and control. Because we all want to have control, that's safety, that's protection of ourselves. And being willing to let go of that to whatever. What are your thoughts
that's
on that?
That's a huge, huge issue. Well, you have to be willing, again, to not worry about whether you succeed or fail, but you try, okay? So being vulnerable is opening and exposing yourself. Because you tell people, I'm going to become a pilot. What if you don't? Well, you're publicly, just socially. Mm-hmm. So it's not just psychologically, it's socially. And you're going to go back and say you failed. Yeah, but I tried. Well, what have you done lately? I tried. So you make, but one of the key things to that, to flying, and I would suggest too, because I've done some other things, NHRA racing and drag racing and things. If you're in control of the aircraft, or if you're in control of the vehicle, you just feel so much better. If you're a passenger in the plane, if you're a passenger in a car, and somebody goes fast, it just seems so much faster. And you having some control, some mastery, is the key to the whole thing. It's gaining it. It's gaining control, and just grabbing it. I've got it.
And it's a physical as well as a psychological and social. You point out there, you say, hey, I'm going to be a pilot. And then if you didn't make it, now you have to look at your friends in the eye and say, guess what? And because I think in our culture, it is like the best team in football is the one that wins the Super Bowl. The worst team is the one who lost the Super Bowl. It's like, give me a break. That whole idea of participation and moving past the fear and showing the courage to move forward, that for me is like the battle right there.
Absolutely.
In the process there, okay, you have these feats and don't want to give the whole book away, in that way, because it's loaded with so much. It seemed, when you were talking earlier, it was like an escalation of challenges. Okay, first just even getting in the plane, sitting next to the pilot, right there. There's a little one there. And then to say, okay, I'm going to take a class. And then you go up and you are with a pilot who's there. And eventually you make your way up to, you're going to fly solo, you're flying a biplane or bi-wing, whatever they're called, right? And I see this as an escalation of challenges that the universe was throwing at you. This is my take on it. What did you find were the most challenging along the way when you look back? Or was it just a steady... It is where it is.
No, clearly every transaction, you might say, every new requirement by FAA. First, you go, you do a number of things, orientation, learn how to fly very, very slow without stalling, learn how to do stall recovery. Then you escalate. I guess I'll use that word to flying long distances by yourself, first a short distance actually by yourself, then longer distances, learning instrument. So you build on, and it's designed that way, you build one on another. But each time, I don't know if this happens to everyone, but it seemed like, whether it was my luck or whatever, it turned into quite a learning experience. For instance, there's three legs as you're supposed to cross country, 100 miles, three legs, triangle, to three different destinations. Well, I'm just a student pilot. I did the best I could to learn about the weather, and my instructor and everybody else was supposed to be helping me along those lines. And so away we go. We're going to fly from Hayward up to Sacramento and over there. And I find myself in going from visual flight rules, visual meteorological conditions, severe clear, nice and blue and clear, to marginal VFR, and then deteriorating into instrument, which means clouds, you can't see very far in front of you. So now I'm on my own. Now I decide either I turn back and run away from this, I got to go back to the airport because I can't handle it. No, I decided to draw on every lesson and every experience and every motivational point that I had gotten from my instructors and fly this thing. And I used all the tactics and techniques that I could think of, and I did it. But I did talk about having drifted a little bit and ended up over an Air Force base. Anyway,
that would be Travis. Like a national defense area.
Yeah, that would
be shot down.
That would be Travis. And I said, but I did do the right thing in terms of transponder, in terms of contacts, and everything else. I think in today's environment, that would be a problem. I would have friends up there with me guiding me down. You know, in other words, they would send up a plane to see who I was for sure. But anyway, so that happened. It is what it is. And then the other challenging thing, and it's calculated risk. Again, it's not daredevil. Everything has it. You can justify it. It makes sense. It may sound daredevilish to some people, but I decided I had heard, okay, let me back up. In Colorado, you're flying an aircraft darn near. If you're going to go over these mountains, first of all, you better have a mountain checkout and endorsement, which I did get. But you understand that you're flying almost at the service ceiling of the aircraft to clear the mountains. In fact, if you go to Leadville and you sit on the runway and it's a hot day, you're at 10,000 feet. Well, if it's a hot day, that has the effect of increasing the aircraft thinks it's flying at a higher altitude. You don't get as much power. And so the air is thin, you know, and it's hot. So there you are. You've already sitting there exceeded the service ceiling of the aircraft. So taking off and landing is it's very different. So flying around at high altitude, I worried about oxygen deprivation, the effects of that they would be subtle, I wouldn't be aware of them. I heard these stories. So I decided that I was going to experiment. And again, it may sound a little bit bold, but it made sense to me. I didn't, because again, I understood that sometimes this effect of oxygen deprivation would be so subtle that you wouldn't feel it coming on, and by the time you realized that you were having this problem, might all be too late. So I wanted to monitor for me personally and the aircraft. I wanted to take it up as high as I could go. I had the oxygen bottle with me, and I had learned how to scale the mountain, so to speak, by going in small circles, riding the waves up and up and up and up. Mm-hmm. So I decided to go over, pick out one. I picked out Mount Massive. I decided to fly up the side of Mount Massive as high as that aircraft could go on its own, and then fly the air currents up and up and up. And I did turn, and I took a picture of this. It's in the book, 18,500 feet, which is substantially over the service ceiling of that aircraft, a Grumman Tiger. But I could feel it, so I put on the oxygen. But point being, you come down, that's it. You don't play around with this. Now I know. Now I got it. I got it. So I add that. And it's not something you go, oh, gee, look what I did. No, I did it because I became a better pilot because of it. Otherwise, all of this is just theory. And theory is just scary because it's a little different as it applies to you and your aircraft. So you better know how to do this, especially if you're going to take people up with you, yeah. Your family, which I did.
Yeah. Talk about that, because what you're getting at here, because you learned to fly basically at sea level in California.
Yes.
Okay. Now you're flying in Colorado, so even if you take off at DIA, you're already a mile above sea level.
Oh, God, yes.
Okay, and then you're dealing with the mountains and the conditions with the wind currents and everything, too, that can take you and twist you and turn. So that whole different environment, too, in altitude, because there was a really interesting, you mentioned your family. And I think it was this, at that time it was called Dulles Airport. Is that still Dulles or National or Reagan?
Dulles Airport. Actually, I took the family up in a small, it was Cessna 172 out of northeastern Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And they didn't take too well to even light current. And they had a little accident. And they all had an accident all over my maps. But at any rate, they enjoyed the flight. Well, the issue with the altitude is quite interesting, though, because I hope it's not too getting into the weeds, but it's at Hayward, California, at the Bay Area, it's 52 feet above sea level. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a little bit lower and you'll drown, and you got the maximum power out of the aircraft, so it's fine. Up here, you sit here, and it's 50. Oh, actually, it was Arapahoe Centennial Airport. That's, damn near 6,000 feet. You lean the mixture because you got to have more air. You got to have more, less fuel and more air as best you can to give it power. So everything is different. It's just very, very different. So, and then when you get way high and then you run into turbulence. Turbulence in Colorado is like nothing else. Our mountain flying in California was around Mount Diablo, which is outside of San Francisco. And it's a big old mountain from a distance, but that's all there is. And it's not that bad, really. Mm-hmm. You fly around, you go, ooh, you want to... Mountain flying in Colorado is a character builder. And there are a lot of accidents. And again, why... Because when I got here, I read about all of these accidents, and where is it's coming from? People from lower altitudes would come up here and act as if their plane could fly here the same way that it might fly down in the lowlands in Texas or somewhere else, and they don't.
And talk about that in the planes, because when I read the book, I noticed, and I don't remember the Cessna, and then there's the Piper, and then different numbers in different planes with their abilities to handle altitude wind drafts. So you had to learn that as well.
Oh, absolutely. And you learn that, I guess maybe the most, that just jumps into my mind, you practice and you fly with a Cessna 150, a little two-seater trainer, right? Down at California or down at the lowlands. Not here.
Like the training wheels.
And they're perfectly adequate. They're perfectly adequate down there, but up here, no. That's a 172 at a minimum, and then 182 is preferable, and that's a heavier aircraft, just heavy, and absorbs a lot of power. And I ended up flying most of the time a Grumman Tiger, because I couldn't get another plane. I was down in Puerto Rico. I was doing some business, and that's all they had was the Grumman Tiger, and I tried one of those, and flew that around the island of Puerto Rico, and very impressive. Mm-hmm. And I even got to fly one in January again. One of the people in one of the groups I belong to is a Marine aviator. He's an active duty colonel, and he's a Harrier jet fighter pilot. Mm-hmm. And he has a Grumman Tiger, and we went up. Lo and behold, right over Corona Pass, over Winter Park, and he let me fly it. And my goodness, I could still fly.
This is kind of like riding the bike then.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, it's good.
And then even flying, I was struck by, and I mentioned like Dulles Airport, because that's a major airport.
Yes.
Compared to Centennial, the little one here. and then the ones you write in Guam and where else in the Pacific, and you know, and landing there on these little dirt strips that are like a couple hundred feet long. I'm overstating it, but that whole experience, it just struck me.
Yeah, Guam was a well, if you want to fly in Guam at the time, if you wanted to fly in Guam at the time, it was marginally airworthy aircraft. The flaps didn't work, actually. there was a number of things, and but I flew over to the island of Rota and back and did some things, and that was... See, they're all interesting experiences, very short runway. The character builder, I'll call it... Well, they're all character builders, but when I went back to Washington, D.C., I wanted to fly, so I went to a club in Dulles Airport, and I was took out some of my consultant friends at one Friday afternoon to show them how it's done. And I hadn't had a lot of experience flying behind DC-10s or having them fly behind me when we're going to land. And so we're coming into Dulles with my buddies, and they're all just pumped up and happy, and isn't this cool? And I hear in the radio, because I didn't have headphones, so they could all hear this, DC-10 behind me, grumbling a little bit. The pilot was, you know, and I'm putting along, doing my exact, you know, textbook landing, 60 miles an hour. And the tower says, you know, Cessna, da da da, no delay. And he kept bugging me about it. And I said, he can, said, I'm paddling as fast as I can. Tell DC-10 to go around or take an alternate runway. It was a little salty then. But what I worried about was, you know, if I wasn't supposed to be there, then maybe they should have put me over in the other general aviation strip in the first place. But I wasn't going to risk the lives of anybody. So they did. Everything worked out. And he said, follow the Concorde. The Concorde? Where in the... Good Lord, where's the Concorde? And that was the super, you know.
The SST?
Yeah, yeah. And where is it? I said, hey, you got anybody see the Concorde? Here it comes. Smooth as silk coming by. And I'm still pedaling. And he lands, and he's pulling off as I'm coming down. I'm still not on the ground, but it all worked out. We had a good laugh.
Was there like a backdraft or anything? Because you're following this humongous. I'm thinking of like, you know, a little sports car or something following a big semi, or having the big semi behind you that's barreling down on you, that metaphor.
There is, if you take off behind one, you have to watch where they're, you know, you have to know the wind direction. Usually you're taking off into the wind and landing. But you need to be to the left or right of the aircraft because of the backdrafts. And but when you're going like this, there's enough separation. And he was down and had landed, so that I'm just fine. But I think I quoted Clint Eastwood in here, man's got to know his limitations. You do have to be careful. You learn some things. You screw up. You do screw up. It's like anything else you do. Racing, I don't care what you do. You make mistakes. You don't go, you know, cry about it. You just learn. You do a little after the fact. You do a little debriefing with yourself and say, so what did I do right, wrong? I'm going to evaluate. I'm going to give myself a grade today. What did I do? What should I need practice on? Anything. I don't care if it's checkers, for crying out loud. It's just you need to think about how you can improve, if you care about improving at all, which most people do. And what should I not do ever again? Those kinds of things.
Yeah, and you know, it's to think of others, you know, and two of the notables, young people that died flying solo, JFK Jr.
Yes,
and John Denver.
Oh Lord, you know, I cited. Oh, it's such a tragedy. I cited those two cases, and even a little thing about how John Denver had to wait for me after a Red Rocks concert.
Oh, yeah,
because he was taking off in his fancy jet, and I was coming in for a landing, and I made up this big story about, oh, John Denver, you have to wait for Tim. You know, but it wasn't quite like that, but he did. But that other incident with John Kennedy Jr., how he passed away, I don't want to... it's what happens when you're not really not prepared, when you don't know your limitations, or you just are so, you're not so, I know I'd be critical of JFK Jr. at this point, but it's a scary way to go. It's at night, going into the dead man's spiral, is what it's called. You stall, you don't trust your instruments, you think you know which orientation you are, your instruments tell you they're accurate, but you're trying to, no, that's not it. You put yourself in a spin, a stall, down you go.
Yeah.
At night, into the water.
Yeah.
Good grief. You talk about the sum of all fears. And there it is. And I thought about that and thought about it and still think about it. That's why I put it in there.
Sure.
It's an incentive for pilots. Just don't do this.
Mm-hmm. And, again, bringing a metaphor, I think, for those of us that are not pilots, but drive into a whiteout blizzard. And when, yes. And I've done that time and time going over Berthoud Pass, I know the road, I would say, by the back, like the back of my hand, I could drive a blindfold, except in a blizzard. And once that whiteout, the road you thought, I mean, it just disappears.
You think you know.
You think you know, and you don't. And an instant fear like that, and, that loss there. So when you look back, Tim, over this whole experience, because it's really about conquering your fear or mm-hmm. facing your fear, whatever. Life lessons for the faint of heart, you call it. And we all have our fears, and those who don't are probably not going to be long for this world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was teaching, and there was a line that from George Washington. He says, there's something romantic about a bullet whistling past your ear.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm thinking, okay, how about romantic if it hits you between your eyes? Mm-hmm. That's a whole other thing mm-hmm. there. So it's wise to have that sense of control and fear and everything too. And yet we don't want it to enslave us, to control us in that way. I guess my big question at the end here is, have you really conquered your fear, or what? Because I think this is all of us have to look at this.
Well, I think, by and large, yes, because it's not dysfunctional. It's not life limiting. Okay, I would say yes to that extent. However, when I am in a plane, commercial aircraft, and we're flying our route somewhere, and it's all well and good, it's smooth air, it's just fine. But when we hit clear air turbulence, and sometimes, as we all know, that clear air turbulence, we're going to have a little light chop up here, they call it. Light chop, my butt, this thing is rocking and rolling. Now, I know what's happening, and I know what they're doing, but sometimes I get so critical, vocal, about why are they not slowing to maneuvering speed? Because you are supposed to do that when it gets to be very moderate to severe turbulence. You really kind of need to slow down. And there is a maneuvering speed for all aircraft, and you should slow down. Otherwise, if you penetrate severe turbulence at a high speed, you could damage the aircraft and the people inside. So I'm all flustered. So sometimes knowledge is not so good. It's
Do you think it affects you more than, say, me? I'm the average, I'm on the plane and we hit turbulence. Okay, it's not a fun thing to go through, but I trust the pilot. I simply have to. Whereas you have an intimate knowledge of flying an aircraft. And so does that add to the mix?
I'm sure I'm like a nut sometimes, because there's another factor too. There was a time when this is not meant to be critical of in general, but there we know that for a long time, commercial airline pilots came out of the military. A lot of them did. Mm-hmm. And those guys have experienced all kinds of things with stall recovery and spin recovery. And sometimes I wonder, now maybe it's just an age thing with me now, but you see their pilot is what? It's quite a bit. Has he really gone through some of this? Could he? And again, it's just being silly. But these are silly little fears. But I say to myself, I wonder if he could recover. If we have an inadvertent stall spin, Can he recover from a spin? Does he know what to do? And it's not even just knowing what to do. It's this presence of mind. You might know theoretically what to do. Can you hit that opposite runner and pull it up without stalling, going into an accelerated stall? Can you just do it without panic? And you can do it if you practice, you know. So, I mean, it's the things like that, you know. I go, oh, gosh.
Absolutely. And, probably the icon in our hero in our age right now is Sully, who landed it on the Watson. How many pilots could have pulled that off?
Oh, there are so many things you have to know to do that right. I only had the one experience when I was flying in Guam and I went across to Rota, and I was working with particularly this plane, you know, that's not airworthy really. And I had a little yellow May West here. I'm going to pull it if I need to, but trying to remember the procedures for landing in water. And there darn sure is a procedure for landing in water properly, or you will just find yourself at the bottom of the drink. So there's that, landing in the water. Which way is the wind blowing? Okay, which way is it going? How high are those waves? Should I land in them? I mean, it's a different way of landing. But keeping your cool in a situation like that is remarkable, just remarkable. And I think any of that kind of thing, whether it's in, I don't go to extremes, but military people in certain situations, they've handled themselves, kept their cool in combat. It's remarkable because there's a tendency to try, you know, duck and cover. But, what a remarkable man.
Yeah. And, you know, looking back again over this, after all these years, you know, starting with that initial opportunity to sit next to the pilot, if you could say something to that younger Tim at that time, would it be like, what were you thinking? What would you say to him? I'm just intrigued by the wisdom you have now accumulated, not only about yourself, but also about the art of flying, because it's a skill and it's an art to me.
What immediately pops into my mind is, good for you. Good. I'm glad you tried it. And I remember every success and every not so successful, just every screw up, but everything I learned from, and I think I gained a lot from it, that actually translated into so many just other kinds of things that made, I think, helped me become successful.
Very good. Very good. Next adventure.
Next is it. I just have to do this because I think it is unique. We've all done a little bit of, when we were young, you know, on the street, you do a little racing, you do, you know. You didn't, right, Jerry? No.
No, just on my bike.
Yeah, okay, right. Well, there's this thing that people did and do, and I kind of got into it. Quite a bit. I joined a car club, the Rocky Mountain Oldsmobile Club, actually, back in the 90s. And I started all that over again, that racing business. And it evolved into Corvette racing with Corvette Connection. It's an organization, it's a business in town, very well known, at Bandimere. And then that was a pretty fast car. I had that all fixed up to go real fast. And then I got another car, ZR1 Corvette, with lots and lots of horsepower, 638 or so, and raced that. And then went to Spring Mountain and raced out in Nevada, did some racing there. And all the way along, there are a lot of interesting stories. Similar, there's some great triumphs and some colossal. And one, the number one lesson that comes out of that, which gives away the whole book, I suppose, you can never be. You know, they used to say in these old Westerns, you can't be the top gun. You can't. There's always somebody better.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You think you're hot stuff. You think your car is fast. No, it's not. Not really. It is for the first two races. Then comes, here it comes.
Yeah.
Takes you by two car lengths. But the whole process is not just describing that. It's just what one does, what one goes through. I think it'd be an interesting thing for people who have done this, and some lessons.
Yeah. So, and success is just doing it. It's not the final, you know, outcome or anything like that. It's participation.
You know, Jerry, that's so true. And like, again, so if you lose,
you
played the game. That's it. That's the whole thing. That's what it comes down to, man. Yeah.
All right. So, I'm sure there'll be a book coming out of this sometime down the road. Mm-hmm. And, because you got the bug now.
Oh,
that's part of the adventure, too. And, if someone wants to pick this up, how can they do that?
Well, Amazon, online on Amazon.
And the title again is?
Flying Upside Down.
He's looking at his book upside down.
Life Lessons for the Faint of Heart. And it'll be the one book where you, when you look at it, if you take it and turn it upside down, you'll see the picture that I took while I was doing a barrel roll facing the Front Range over what is now Centennial Airport. Well, a little west of that. Barnes & Noble and Amazon.
Amazon. And your other book is?
Marines Never Cry.
Yeah, very powerful.
Becoming a Man When It Mattered.
Yeah.
And it's a tribute to the truckers, the unsung heroes of Vietnam, truck drivers of all things. I think you might find it interesting. It's not a shoot 'em up. It's a very different kind of approach to the Vietnam War.
Yeah, it is very personal and it's a very human story there. So, all right, everyone, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9. And this has been Writer's Talk on the Rabbit Hole, visiting here with my good friend Tim Hall, talking about his work, Flying Upside Down, Life Lessons for the Faint of Heart. And if people want to get a hold of you, what's a good way to do that, Tim? You have an email or anything?
I do. And it just happens to coincide with the color and horsepower of the Corvette that I was driving. It is jetstream638@gmail.com. Jetstream blue. How about that?
All right. Sounds great. All right. Thanks, everyone. And we'll be back. Bye now.